Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by Robert and Dana Baer, who are the authors of a new book, The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. Robert Baer is a veteran CIA operations officer and the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. Dana Baer was also an accomplished CIA operative specializing in protection and surveillance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer and Dana Baer.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ian.
And let me begin with you, Robert, just because in the earlier interview we did with the specialist from Cairo on both Egypt and Libya, there was talk of some covert activity on the part of the CIA in Libya. My understanding is that one of the problems that the CIA has is that all of its Arab-speaking assets are either in Iraq or in Afghanistan. And I'm just wondering, if you were still in the agency, who would they be sending there?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, you know, we've had two wars now that have drawn away people for these deployments that go for 6 months, and no one's got time for language. You don't have time to train Arabists. CIA, 50% of the people have come in since 9/11. It's a figure I haven't confirmed, but I think it's fairly accurate. And who remembers the Libyans? We've forgotten the last 10 years. And, you know, you see these old exiles being sent back, and it's a real dog's breakfast. You know, what's going on in Benghazi? Who's in control? There's a transitional council, but are they really in control? There was fighting yesterday between the military commanders, and apparently this strike on the rebels was caused by disorganization on the side of the Libyans.
And Dana, if you were still in the agency, you mentioned in the book, The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife's True Life Spy Story, is one of your colleagues was one of these people who get whipsawed all the time and sent abroad, and you didn't want that to be your fate.
No, I know. You know, that was eventually one of the reasons that we left, is just because you're gone all the time, and you're working in a different name, and you know there's no phone calls, there's no emails home, and you know that's part of one of the themes of the books, as you know, is just the separation and the alienation that it creates in families.
And in terms of your towards the end of the book, your attempts to adopt an orphan in Pakistan. It sort of reminds me or brings up some of the issues that we were just discussing then with a former UN political officer in Afghanistan over the reaction to the burning of the Quran by an obscure Florida pastor and the double standard in Pakistan, where recently a minister was murdered and his murder was celebrated, whereas the burning of this Quran is causing all of this mayhem. Is that the environment that you're dealing with?
Yeah, I mean, you've got this whole trend in Pakistan, the Deobandis, which are, you know, it's an oversimplification, but they're Wahhabis. And the little girl we adopted is Christian. Her mother had died. And it is a beleaguered community. And they certainly don't have, you know, the right to defend themselves, or they will, you know, just as the ministers. The anti-blasphemy laws that he was questioning them, and he was assassinated as well. So it is very much one-sided, but that doesn't forgive this Florida pastor who was just an unnecessary act of hate. It's not Christian at all.
But Dana, in terms of the nail-biting process that you went through there. It does feel that both the Christian community is beleaguered, and that there's this general sense at the last minute when you finally your last barrier is going through the customs at Pakistan with your new child, you know, where he says, "Why didn't you adopt a Muslim child?"
Right, right. You know, it was a harrowing experience, and you know, we had a Pakistani lawyer who we listened to because we didn't know otherwise, and we actually went through an initial guardianship proceeding. And it wasn't until we came out of that proceeding that our lawyer told us that the judge was Taliban. And we had been required to prove our bona fides at that time. And in the only way we knew how to do that, and in fact this was on the advice of the lawyer, was to provide a copy of one of Bob's books. So it immediately became clear to the judge who we were and where we had worked. And, you know, we were denied guardianship at that point. So the whole, yes, it was very precarious. We did succeed on appeal with our lawyer's help, but yes, and then you know you're constantly worried, as we were when we were leaving the airport, and you know, we were being questioned as to our daughter's faith. So yes.
But just to go back to the decision to adopt, let me ask Bob, did you mention in the book that you originally thought of adopting a child from Chechnya, and your Russian KGB contact there sort of said, well, I don't know of any orphans, but we can maybe create one for you, which was a...
That was, you know, all through this book, we try to introduce a little bit of humor. It's a very self-deprecating book, and I did call up the chief of a intelligence service, a KGB officer in the Caucasus, and he said, yeah, oh, Mr. Bob, he had a very hard time understanding me exactly what I wanted. And then when I wanted to tell him I wanted to adopt a Chechen, he paused for a while and said, if we can't find orphan, we make orphan for you. And it was his sense of humor. But
Dana, what I'm sure the audience wanted to know why you and Bob chose first a Chechen child, and then secondly a child from the Pakistan, Afghanistan
area. We really wanted to adopt from someplace we'd been before, some area of the world where we worked, where we knew people, where we would be likely to go back, where we could bring an adopted child back and hopefully keep her in contact with her culture, relatives, if she had any. So, you know, Chechen, Bob had worked in Azerbaijan, and so that was sort of our first thought, and we narrowed down to Pakistan. I had worked there, and Bob had been there, and it was a place where we found out we could adopt, and we could do it independently, sort of on our own. There's no agencies, no adoption agencies that work there, and that was something else we wanted to do, was we wanted to be hands-on about it.
And you both met when Dana was assigned to you, Bob, as a shooter to protect you in Sarajevo, where you were chasing down a Hezbollah cell who was setting up a shop there. What I find interesting about your book, the new book, The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife's True Life Spy Story, is your grudging admiration for the Iranians of having pulled off a bunch of attacks on the United States in essentially an undeclared war that they've had since 1979, and that basically they've gotten away with it, with all of their attacks on the U.S.
Well, it was, you know, it was more than that. It was the tradecraft. I'd been in Beirut in the 80s and had watched these people. They never maintained a fixed base. They never were up on phones. Their addresses were impossible to run down. They were a moving target. And moving targets are very hard to hit in this world. So what I wanted to do in Sarajevo, since Hezbollah in Iran was targeting us there, was to make the CIA people working for me a moving target. You know, we changed houses every couple of weeks, cars every week, changed plates, rotated people in and out. So they didn't really have a fixed base. Hezbollah didn't, to focus on. You know, this was something completely novel, but it seemed to be the place to do it without, you know, a central state. You know,
it wasn't without cost, though, Dana. One of your colleagues, a female colleague of yours, with your detail, was shot.
Yes, and you know, we were operating a what we're calling a parabolic mic. That was when we did locate a Hezbollah resident safe house that we decided to target. We set up this mic, and we were basically listening to conversations through walls, and it became fairly clear that somebody was watching us, watching Hezbollah, and then subsequently one of our teammates was driving just slightly outside of town and was ambushed, and she was shot. She did survive, but it became clear that we were unable to separate what actually happened there and whether the operation had been compromised or not, and we eventually had to close it down.
But as you mentioned in the book, though, that an operation that ends with somebody getting shot is an example of a failed operation. That the whole purpose of what you and your husband did in the CIA was that nobody knew about it, and that contrary to what we see in James Bond movies, where it's all about guns and assassination and car chases, the opposite is true in the real world.
No, you never, Ian, you never want to be seen in espionage. You'll notice with MI6, you never see their name plastered across the newspapers unless there's been some sort of horrible failure, like a mole, like, you know, the Cambridge Five. The whole idea of espionage is to be able to do it quietly, legally as well, in the sense of you don't want to be breaking your own national laws. And so, like, when we see this finding, covert action finding, published in the papers last week about Libya, that is a failure by definition, because, you know, we don't want the world to know that we're backing one side in Libya at this point, other than a no-fly zone. So yes, it was a failure, and in this book we talk about, you know, this constant attempt to disappear overseas.
Well, but you also talk about in the book, when you talk about moles, one of the great tragedies there is that your friend that you befriended in the boondocks of Tajikistan, the KGB guy that was there that you tried to win over, when you finally got him to come to the United States and they gave him the full-on tour of the United States, and even going to set up his two daughters at Clemson College because they wanted to be educated in the United States, that in the final briefing at the CIA, one of the briefers that joined the team was Aldrich Ames, the double agent. And, of course, his last act before he was arrested was to give up your friend whose life and career was destroyed. And, you know, Ames' first act was to give up Oleg Gordievsky, the valuable double agent the Brits had, and his last act was to give up your friend. But at the same time, the CIA knew that at that point that Ames was working for the other side. It's almost incomprehensible.
Well, it's this whole idea of betrayal. I mean, you know, me and this KGB officer were throwaways in this operation. What was happening at the time was that Ames was closer to being arrested, and the FBI came to the CIA and said, we'll do anything to keep him thinking that he's not under suspicion. One way to do that was to introduce him to sensitive cases, which was one of mine. Ames knew that I was attempting to recruit this KGB officer, and they also had told Ames about the same time that he was going to take over Russia House. And what they were doing in this was giving the Russians some baits. You know, there was no way that the Russians could, you know, pull him out and take him to Moscow. What everybody was afraid of was there was another mole besides Ames who would find out about the investigation. You know, it's all spy versus spy. It's a very gray area. But what that told me, the lesson was that just as I had sacrificed people in my career in espionage, I got sacrificed.
Well, though, you also got hung out to dry, because I think, again, the audience would find it almost incomprehensible that you had been in contact with a group of Iraqi generals who were intent upon a coup against Saddam Hussein. They had a plan to surround his villa in Tikrit with the tanks. It was all it looked like it was going to work. The CIA got cold feet. And then the FBI came after you for violating the assassination of foreign leaders statute. So that's in itself incomprehensible, given the fact that what happened later to get rid of Saddam, the Iraq War, was such a tragedy.
But yeah, this is a very personal book, because what you do is you see both Dana and me as coming in fairly young, fairly naive, and figuring out through this book the way the world works, and it's fairly brutal. I mean, right. In Iraq, when this coup was going down, I was sending a message every day saying, this is what they plan to do, this is how they're going to do it, what is your position in Washington? And never got an answer. And then once it went bad, of course, they sent the FBI after me and my team.
And just in closing then, with Dana, let me ask Dana about the other great tragedy in the story, which is the two friends that you both had, Marwan and Malik, both Iraqis, and you were going to go in together, you and Bob, for ABC News in before the last Iraq war, before Operation Iraqi Freedom, as it's called, and the Malik was helping you get in, and lo and behold, he gets hit by 6 cruise missiles, and his entire family gets wiped out.
Yes, it was, you know, I think the biggest sadness in our life so far. And just, yeah, they were going to help us go in. We were going to, for ABC News, we were going to record the reactions to Saddam's fall and stay in the Western Desert in their compound. And we had met with them in Jordan just in the lead up to the war, and they were recruiting some Bedouin to take us across the border, and just before we were ready to go, yes, we got notice that the compound had been hit by 6 American JDAM missiles, and Malik was killed, and all the women and children who had been gathered in a separate house for the evening were killed. So yes, it was a very serious and sad wake-up call for us.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank both of you for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Rob and Dana Baer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Rob and Dana Baer, authors of a new book, The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife, True Life Spy Story. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is One Time, One Night by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. If you heard something you like, something that you don't like, any suggestions or tips, let us know. We read every email. You can also check out my blog at ianmasters.com. Click on blog. I'll be back tomorrow with another Background Briefing. That's at 5 p.m. Monday through Thursdays here at KPFK. Bye for now. Just when everything seemed right, another headline written down.